Got a few emails from some folks. Some folks can't make it this week. Others can. That's okay. We're recording everything, so it's all downloaded. And will be available as part of a package when all this is over, said, and done. I just hope everybody's okay today. If everyone can mute their microphones, that would be fantastic. If you do have a question and you want to know something immediately, raise your hand. This week is going to be a little bit different than some of the other weeks, because we're going to really focus in on a couple of books that a lot of people aren't familiar with, but it's really important that Christians are familiar with them, because they really form the basis of a lot of Christian thought, and we don't know that. And it answers a lot of questions, but we'll get to that in a second. So for those of you just joining the conversation, I do apologize if I seem a little spaced out. I had a crazy weekend, a fantastic weekend, hanging out with some lovely folks that I haven't had the opportunity to hang out with in quite a while. And we were actually at a conference this weekend volunteering, and we had our four kids with us, ages 8, 5, 4, and 3. So if you know anything about my family, it means I feel like I ran a marathon right now, as does my wife. But there was so much joy involved this weekend. So I'm kind of if I seem a little spacey, it's a good thing. I hope it runs off into tonight's session. So I want to thank everybody for their questions that they've been sending me, their ideas, responses sent via email. If I haven't gotten to your question yet, I promise I'm not ignoring you. But I'm really excited about the response from last week's class and the challenges it brought up to a lot of folks. And I also want to clear something up that someone asked. Someone asked if I thought that apocryphal works that we discussed last week should be held in the same regard as canonized scripture. And honestly, my answer to that is no, I don't. I think scripture is scripture. I think the established canon is the established canon for a reason. But I do believe that apocryphal works and Gnostic works and things like that, that I do believe that Christians should know about them. I don't think it's something we should ignore. I don't think they are things that will lead you astray. I don't think that they are things that will negatively impact your faith, because if a book can negatively impact your faith, then your faith is in the wrong thing. And that's just kind of where I stand on that. I think it's important that we understand the works that influenced early Christians. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but it's especially from a historical standpoint. And tonight I'm going to talk about two books in particular that I touched on last week. I'm going to go into more detail because they are books that are not considered canon in the Christian faith or the Jewish faith. Well, that's not entirely true. There are strains of Christian, Christian denominations is a strong word, maybe sects, S-E-C-T-S, sects, that do consider them canon, like Ethiopia, called Eritrean Christians. But we're going to touch on some of these books tonight. And when I talk about these books, I'm going to show you exactly how they really form the basis of a lot of things that Christians believe. And you're going to be like, why have I never heard about this before? And the reason that is because it does bring up uncomfortable questions. So that's kind of what we're going to delve into tonight. So is everybody okay? Everybody good? All right. Nobody's screaming hellfire brimstone right now, so I think we're okay. All right. So we're going to jump back into it today, pick up where we left off last week. We're going to talk about who crafted the Bible, what made its books canon or extra biblical. And we're really going to dive into the legends and the conspiracies surrounding it, the apocryphal and pseudo epigraphical. We're not going to have time to touch too much on the Gnostic works tonight. We'll go back into that next week. But I know we kind of left on a cliffhanger last week. And so because last week, it's like I brought up all of these books that are floating around when the gospels are being formed. Like we have been taught, you know, and seminaries don't really teach this anymore, but 40, 50 years ago, like the seminaries my father went to, you know, the way they talked about this book's construction, it was a very straight as an arrow. This is how it was done, and et cetera, et cetera. But history, there's been a lot of discoveries over the last, you know, 50, 60 years, and a lot of things have come out to light, and we realize that that is not not true in any way, shape, or form. But it doesn't diminish this book in any way, and I think it makes it more. I think it makes it more beautiful. I think it makes it the whole idea of divine inspiration. I feel like it thickens and it and like becomes a thick, beautiful thing, and all of a sudden, it is the word of God, and you realize how it is has become the way it is. So before we start, just want to pray real fast and just say, Lord, we just thank you. We thank you for who you are, that we can call you Papa, that we can call you Dad, that we thank you for your Son. We thank you for the Holy Spirit and the divine dance that we're placed within this Trinity. And we just love you. We love your word, and we love your big word, and we love your little word. because it does draw us closer to you. So Lord, we just thank you. Amen. All right. So I want to dive back in. So this week we're going to focus on what's called the intertestamental period. That means today is what's called rabbit hole day. we are going to take a huge detour into some fascinating books that deeply impacted the early church and thus the crafting of what would eventually become the Bible. Protestants often refer to the intertestamental period between the Old and New Testaments as the Age of Silence. And it's a period where it's not believed that God spoke to his chosen people in Israel for a little over 400 years. Basically from around the end of the Great Assembly, where the Hebrew Bible was put together. So before it was converted into the Septuagint, but the original Hebrew Bible, when that was put together, until the beginning of John the Baptist's ministry. That is typically what Protestants refer to as the Age of Silence. But it wasn't really silent. And can you guys see this little graph right here? The timeline? Yes? No? Okay. So here's a basic timeline of, I talk about what's called the exilic period, the pre-exilic, post-exilic. Basically, that's when, and this is very important for today, when the Jews were taken captive into Babylon. And then when the Babylonian rule ends and the second temple period second temple is dedicated, that's when Nehemiah comes in, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's this period that when Nehemiah comes, again, I know you guys are familiar with the story. If not, I'm going to fill you in real quickly. Nehemiah, he has this feeling, this urge, these dreams, this vision to go back and help rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And he's serving in the Babylonian court, which at that time is under Persian rule. And so he goes back and begins temple construction. Now, during that time, basically, what is Judah is no longer their own sovereign nation. They are under the control of the Persian Empire. And the Persians will rule until about the 330s. This says 336, and that's fine. That's probably correct. And then Greek influence really begins. And this is an important period. This is when the Age of Silence is supposed to be going on. And in the Protestant church, it's taught that, hey, during this time, this is, you know, God was silent. He wasn't really speaking to his chosen people anymore. And when you look back at it historically, you realize God probably was not silent during this period. I mean, honestly, when has God ever been silent? I can't think of a time. If we're not hearing God, that's on us, not on him. And he speaks constantly. And this, you know, this may have been the case that God wasn't speaking then, but there have been plenty of books that came out of this time that are considered deuterocanonical, or apocryphal, and they would become part of the Apocrypha in the Protestant tradition. But as you can see, there were a lot of books that were made during this time. There were a lot of books, and this isn't even scratching on the surface, to be honest with you. But these are like the official apocryphal books. And you can see if you remember from past classes, the Codex Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, as well as Alexandrinus, those are our earliest New Testaments that have been discovered. And they have all been discovered within the last 120 years, all after the 1611 King James Version, all basically revealing that, wow, the early church, their New Testament canons actually had a lot more books than what we do now. It's not that they've been taken out intentionally. That's not necessarily a true statement, but there's really not been a huge conspiracy behind it. It's just been, loads of debates and things like that make sure. I don't know if that's sharing right now. If it's so, we've got Codex Vaticanus, the Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Alexandrinus, the Greek Orthodox Deuterocanonical, Roman Catholic Deuterocanonical, and then the Protestant. These are all considered deuterocanonical or apocryphal books, books that were not part of the established canon, but the early church had an extremely high regard for. And while the modern Protestant church, rejects the Apocrypha and pseudo-epigraphical works, the church, the first few centuries, they really held the apocryphal works and a number of pseudographical works in high regard. We talked a little bit about why the Apocrypha was eventually rejected by the Protestant church last week. But the early church, they really did believe, in the validity of these books. This is actually, let me bring up a slide. This is a guy named Athanasius. And Athanasius is a fourth century church father. We're going to talk a bit about him next week. He's actually one of the earliest church fathers to list out what he believed to be canonical books. Athanasius listed the books of the New Testament as basically the familiar 27, the four gospels, actually the apostles, the seven general epistles listed in the 14 Pauline epistles, including the letter to Hebrews, and the book of Revelation. So Athanasius is one of the first to kind of come up with a canon that we eventually know today. His order that he had everything in was a little bit different. But, you know, here's what he had to say about the Apocrypha. But for the greater exactness, I add this also, writing of necessity, that there are other books beside these not included in the canon, but appointed by the fathers to be read by those who newly join us and who wish for instruction in the word of godliness, the wisdom of Solomon, the wisdom of Sirach and Esther and Judith and Tobit, and that which is called the teaching of the apostles and the shepherd of Hermas. Well, he calls it the shepherd, but it's the shepherd of Hermas. But the former, my brethren, are included in the canon, the latter being merely read. So it's this whole idea that, this whole idea that Apocrypha bad, Apocrypha not supposed to be read, Apocrypha horrible for you. That's a pretty recent belief that came across, with Sola Scriptura. Athanasius was a church father who worked in Arianism. And I talked about that a little last week. That was a heresy that stated Jesus was not equal to God. It's the first heresy that the Catholic state, or rather not the Catholic state, but the Roman state would pursue and try to put out, would actually seek to punish. And Athanasius, he was a Trinitarian. He endorsed the belief of God being three in one, one in three, much like we do today. And he believed the apocryphal works. They were worthy of study. That would be the norm for the next 1300, 1400 years. But as Protestants, especially those of us from evangelical charismatic backgrounds, we've been taught to be extremely suspicious of apocryphal works because of sola scriptura. And there are reasons for sola scriptura, for absolutely, because what the Catholic Church was doing at that time, when during the Protestant Reformation or right before, wasn't good, selling of indulgences and things like that. But apocryphal works were considered standard. They weren't something to be feared. But like I said, last week, there were many works going around during the first intertestamental period. And here's just a brief list of some of the pseudo-epigraphica. Now, the pseudo-epigrapha, basically that means falsely written, falsely attributed. Basically, some of them were prophetic, apocalyptic style books. And here's a small list, this is a very, very small list. I had a much larger list last week, but I couldn't cram everything on the screen for you guys to read. But these are some of the more popular ones on there. You do see Enoch, you do see Jubilees, and things like the Assumption of Moses. Now, the reason they're called pseudepigrapha or epigraphica is that obviously Adam and Eve did not write the life of Adam and Eve, and Enoch most likely did not write the book of Enoch. He might have written some other things that were passed down orally, but the actual book of Enoch was written about the 3rd century BC. So while they are attributed to people, they didn't write it. And again, we have to take our modern day blinders off. And pseudo-epigraphica, or pseudo-epigraphic works, do not mean false. For instance, like they mean falsely written or falsely attributed, but not false as in not worthy of study. For instance, we've talked at length about, it is obvious that Paul did not write a number of the letters that are attributed to his name. Doesn't mean they are not divinely inspired. Doesn't mean any of that stuff. It just simply means that someone else wrote it under his name, or let Paul take the credit, but he wasn't the one to write it. And most likely they were disciples of Paul. That was a standard thing to do in that time period. Like we have this image in our head of Paul sitting at a desk or sitting there in chains in a prison cell and writing letters and stuff like that. That's not really how it worked. Our teachers traditionally had disciples who actually wrote everything down for them. Some of those letters are most likely in Paul's hands, especially the earliest ones. But later on, a number of his disciples probably wrote them, and that's okay. But we've discussed all this, so let's get to the new stuff. So I'm going to pause for a second, and I want to ask a simple question. You don't have to answer. I don't want you to answer, but I just want you to think about it, because it's something that you've probably thought about before, but we're either told to put it aside, or it made you uncomfortable, so you stopped thinking about it. And it's a very simple question. And like I said, it's more reflective than anything else. So here it is. Why is the Old Testament and the New Testament so different? Have you ever for a moment taken a pause thinking about it? I mean, the New Testament is more different than the Star Wars original movies and the prequels and the follow-up movies. It is. It's very jarring. When you read the Old Testament, you get to the end of the Old Testament, and then you go into the New Testament, and there are huge, huge differences. I mean, have you ever read this book? There are huge differences. Differences in, for instance, demons, like the way the demonic operates in the New Testament is very different than the way it does in the Old Testament. There's a difference in the spiritual world, the way that they regard the spiritual world. There's a difference in good versus evil, angels and their interactions with humans. I mean, like the New Testament, literally from the very beginning. Like, you open it up and it's on. Angels are coming up to Mary. Angels are talking to Joseph. Angels are, you know, cheering on the Most High. Like, there's, it's angels, angels, angels. There's, it's just like all this stuff. Even the very nature of God as reflected in Jesus, a God of love. Is this the same God that would call for the destruction of nations, but now is the God of love? It's a hard question. And it's one of the biggest questions I get asked as a missionary, as a pastor, as a teacher. Why is God in the Old Testament presented this way, and in the New Testament, he's presented this way? And it's not like it's bad or good. It's just extremely different. It's like the idea or the thoughts behind these beings has gone under a major, I hate using the word evolution because you say evolution in front of a lot of Christians and they kind of get weird. But the understanding of God has really evolved. Okay. And there's the concept that we talked about, progressive revelation of who God is fully revealed in Jesus Christ. And that's part of the beauty of this book is that when you read the Old Testament, when you understand that it's multivocal and not univocal, like we talked about, and like this, you have a lot of different people bringing their ideas and everything like that to this, even though they are divinely inspired, they're kind of bringing their own idea of who God is and what God is and all that stuff. And then you get to the Gospels and you have the full realization of who God actually is in Jesus Christ. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Anything you've heard it said, but I say, right? But it goes beyond that, the New Testament and Old Testament, doesn't it? Why is the Jewish religion and Christianity so distinctly different? Knowing if you've ever sat in a Jewish synagogue, which I have, one of my good friends from a long time ago is Jewish, and I went with him. If you've ever gone to a Jewish synagogue, there is very little in common it has in any way with a charismatic church service or even a Catholic church service. There are so many differences. And when we go from the Old Testament and then to the New Testament, there are huge differences, massive differences. In Christianity, the question of good versus evil is also quite different. You can look at the role of the figure of Satan. In Christianity, Satan is much more powerful and central to the role of good versus evil. If you go back and read the Hebrew Bible, or if you go back and you read the Septuagint, if you go back and read that text, you'll find few mentions of Satan outside of Job. It's in the New Testament that Satan's referred to as the ancient serpent, but not the Hebrew Bible. In the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, the devil is ultimately subordinate to God to carry out purposes on earth, or he's representative in the Jewish faith tradition. It's representative of the sinful impulses that can pull you away from divine will, at least in Main Street. They don't really believe in a devil the way that a lot of Christians do. It doesn't mean that there are strains of mystical Judaism and things like that absolutely do. But for most mainstream Jewish folks, if you go and you say, well, hey, tell me about the devil, they'll go, hey, that's your guy, not our guy. So what happens in the New Testament when you begin to read, there's obviously some kind of hierarchy going on in the spirit world that was not there before. There's a hierarchy. When you go in and you read in Revelation, there's a hierarchy of the demonic. There's a hierarchy of the angelic. There's all of the sorts of stuff that didn't go in deep in the Old Testament. Have you ever thought that's a little strange? Well, these differences, they came during what's called the intertestamental period. That's when these differences began to come into play during this period around pretty much from around 418 to about 37 BC. In this 400-year period, that is when all of a sudden things start to change. So today it's an interesting rabbit hole. I personally believe it's very important understanding how the early Christian religion grows, and thus how its texts first begin to come together. I mean, last week we covered 1,400 years of history. I know that's wild. This week we're going to cover about 400 years. And it's a 400-year period that is not taught about in a lot of churches. So a lot of this information I'm going to give you today, it unless you've spent considerable time with the Apocrypha, a lot of stuff is going to be brand new for you. So it's really excited. So last week we talked, or for the last couple of weeks, we talked about the Bible started as oral stories that became written stories. We talked about that we were told that one person wrote this and one person wrote that, but it was actually one person may have written it at the beginning, but it eventually became a lot more than that. You had different levels of editing. This work is the entanglement of many different hands over many different periods of time. There's no conspiracy at all. There's no ill intent. We learn that the first recorded stories we have evidence for is Exodus 15, called the Song of the Sea, but also referred to as the Song of Moses and Miriam, or simply the Song of Moses. And then we have the Song of Deborah, the story of Samson and Job. Those are the first written down, what's believed to be written down stories of the faith traditions of the Israelites. So each successive generation that comes, they add to these works. They bring into these writings their understanding of God, how God worked in the lives of men and women, how they've seen God work. And kings like Josiah, they rose up in the late 7th century. They wanted reform. They wanted purification of the religious practices, separation from Canaanite practices. So stories begin to take on aspects of purification. And as things like consolidation of worship in Jerusalem became the norm in the 5th century after the return from the Babylonian exile, the need to see instances of sacrifice and purity of the past became a common theme. So they wouldn't return to the ways of their ancestors, and what it's believed actually led to exile. So let me explain it like this. Let me put this in real terms for us to understand, because this is really important. And I know I talk about this topic a lot, but I want you to grasp this. And then after this mention, I'll probably stop talking about this. An entire generation of children, Israelite, what was our Judean children, had been raised in captivity in Babylon under the influence of their gods and their culture. And when they returned to Jerusalem, they needed to firmly establish their beliefs. So think about it like this. Let me put it in real terms that we can all understand. How much of your world has been influenced by the last 70 years of culture? How much of your world has been influenced by the last 70 years of culture? How much has this world changed since 1950? How much has culture changed within your own sphere since you were a child? Now imagine being taken from your land to a completely different culture, a culture much more large and in charge than your own. The population of Jerusalem at the time of exile was a drop in the bucket compared to that of Babylon. So when people were brought into Babylon, they were astounded. The sights, the sounds, the technology. And once there, you begin to have children and you tell them of stories of how things used to be. But now they're in this new, very technologically advanced place under the influence of many different cultures. Literally the center of the ancient world on this part of the earth. Your children are trained in this place, raised in this place. They become adults in the place. They have children of their own in this place. And you work hard to teach them your traditions, your stories, your past, your pain, your love of where you're from. But when you were taken from this place, you were just a child too. And those that held fast to their Hebraic religion, they have a really rough go of it. They're most likely made fun of. They don't have access to the same worship of God as they would normally like. There was no temple structure, and everything at that time for the Jewish people was surrounded around the temple. So the ones that did, they held fast to their faith. They stayed within their community. And most Jews taken in the exile, when that day came 70 years later, when they were told that they could go home, well, whatever was left of it, most of them, if they had been brought from that place, if they had any memory at all from that place, they're now in their 80s because they're in captivity for 70 years. That is historic, verifiable, absolutely true fact. We have cuneiform tablets. All right. So your children are in their 50s and 60s, completely raised, only thinking of your past home as a legend, a story that used to be told. And leaving Babylon and its ways behind to go back to Jerusalem wasn't easy for some of them. They didn't all leave at one time. It was kind of like historians have gone back and they've seen it. It's been like a trickle. And here was another part. And this is not talked about in the Bible, but historic record goes into what life was like for the Hebrews in exile in Babylon. And it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad as long as they towed the cultural line. As long as they agreed to assimilate, they had it pretty good. Over 100 cuneiform tablets have been discovered that actually discusses this fact. The Babylonians, they were hyperactive record keepers. And in many ways, the Babylonian system was extremely bureaucratic. They kept records of everything. So we actually know how the exiles lived. The Bible itself states in 2 Kings 25:30, Jeremiah 52, 31 through 44, or 34 rather, that the king of Jerusalem, Jehoiakim, was given special treatment even over other imprisoned kings. Cuneiform ration lists discovered in Nebuchadnezzar's palace in Babylon, they show that captive kings, high officials, and their descendants received monthly rations of grain and oil. They didn't have to work. The lives of non-royals are even preserved in Babylonian records. Texts from Nippur, they actually contain the names of Hebrews who served as witnesses in land contracts, meaning they owned land and they held status. They could tell the names easily because they had what's called Yahwistic names, names formed from the Israelite divine name, Yahweh, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And records have also been found of business ownership of Hebraic families and entrepreneurship. And records from the city of Susa, which is, if you're familiar with the story of Esther, that's Shushan. So that references Judahites serving as members of the royal court. And in Sippar, a few Yahwistic names appear under the designation royal merchants. What I'm saying is it wasn't all roses and rainbows for everybody in Babylon. I'm not saying that at all. But if you were willing to toe the party line in Babylon and assimilate, which it seems like plenty of people were willing to do, then you were granted amazing privileges and thrived. Archaeological and DNA evidence suggests that most taken into captivity into Babylon, when the return from exile began, they didn't go back. They migrated elsewhere. They migrated north. And there, you can look in the DNA record, like all those DNA genealogy tests that we take and all this stuff. It proves it time and time in. So we have to, and I'm telling you all of this because I want to make this real for you to understand that it wasn't cut and dry. Oh, the exile's over. All the Jews went back to Jerusalem. It's not how it worked. These people were now part of the Persian Empire. And Judah became the province of Judah. It wasn't its own. They had no sovereignty anymore. They were a province of Judah. They had different borders, smaller territory. Population of the province was greatly reduced. Archaeological surveys, I think, put everything about 30,000 people in the 5th and 4th centuries. But this is the thing. And this is where our Old Testament comes from. So those that did return to Jerusalem and did not stay in Babylon and didn't go elsewhere, they were the ones that were called back to their true faith. They were the ones that when they were in captivity, held fast to their belief system, didn't bow to other gods, didn't assimilate. And I know a lot of this sounds contrary to what a lot of people have been led to think about the Babylonian exile, like, oh, the Jews, it was horrible. And like it wasn't all roses and rainbows from everyone, but this was not Egypt. This was not slavery. They weren't being whipped. They weren't being forced to build things. They are, I don't think they built the pyramids, but whatever else is going on, like, that's going on. And yes, we have like Psalm 137, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat and wept as we thought of Zion. But that is written by faithful believers for their lost home, under the watchful gaze of their God. And they wanted to return to be under him. So let me talk about that real quick. In Near Eastern cultures at that time, anthropologists, historians, they've long suggested that people believed different areas, and we're going to talk about this a lot in a little bit, were under the domain of individual gods. So when countries went to war with one another, it was God against God as well. And kind of like the story of, Dagon, whenever they put the Ark of the Covenant in the presence of Dagon would fall over. This is common. This is when people were taken physically. This is one reason Babylon took people from their lands. When people were taken from their land, they no longer believed that they were in a place that was under the stewardship of their God. Okay. But of course, to the Hebrew people, and this is what makes them extremely unique and what makes them extremely beautiful, because this is where their stubborn and stiff-neckedness comes in handy. They never have ever believed that it was their God that was defeated. So even when Jerusalem was sacked by Babylon and utterly, and the temple was destroyed, it wasn't God that was defeated. It was that he removed his protection. It was that he allowed it to happen. And you might think that sounds crazy, but a lot of us still do that today. I'm going to show you something that is extremely, extremely common. So this is a very common, verse that we have. If my people are called by my name, humble themselves, pray, seek my face, and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and forgive their sin and heal their land. 2 Chronicles 7:14. I mean, in the United States, where I'm from, that's on billboards driving down the highway, right? Like that's everywhere. Like that is a common thing. I can probably go on Facebook and find about 20 posts right now. And it's a great verse. I don't mean to take anything away from it. But in context, let's expand and look at this verse in context, because context is king. Well, Jesus is king, but context is important. So in context, this verse changes. It's when I shut up the heavens so that there is no rain, or command the locusts to devour the land, or send pestilence among my people. If my people who are called by my name humble themselves, pray, seek my face, and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land. Now, ouch, wait a second. So now this verse changes a little bit, okay? So the pestilence is sent by God, okay? The pestilence is sent by God. So now let's step back further and get more context, because what's actually going on in this scene, all right? What's going on here is that this is what God is telling Solomon after the dedication of the temple, which was supposed to have happened somewhere between 970 and 930 BC. Then the Lord appeared to Solomon in the night and said to him, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. When I shut up the heavens so that there is no rain, or command the locusts to devour the land, or send pestilence among my people, if my people who are called by my name humble themselves, pray, seek my face, and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and heal their land. Now my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to the prayer that is made in this place. For now I've chosen and consecrated this house so that my name may be there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. As for you, if you walk before me as your father David walked, doing according to all that I have commanded you and keeping my statutes and my ordinances, then I will establish your royal throne is that I have made a covenant with your father David, saying, you shall never lack a successor to rule over Israel. But if you turn aside and forsake my statutes and my commandments that I have set before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will pluck you up from the land that I have given you and this house, which I have consecrated for my name. I will cast out of my sight and will make it a proverb and a byword among all people. And regarding this house, now exalted, everybody passing by will be astonished and say, why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this house? Then they will say, because they abandoned the Lord God of their ancestors who brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they embraced other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore, he has brought all this calamity upon them. Okay, now it's all kind of different, isn't it? And this is from Chronicles. And Chronicles on the timeline, we talked about this, may have been sourced from earlier documents and stories, but data is firm. The majority of Chronicles was written after the exile. How do we know? Grammar, word choice, structure. Remember, I've gone over all that with you guys, so I don't have to do it again. But also, it's in Chronicles. 2 Chronicles mentions the decree made by King Cyrus of Persia allowing the Jews to return to Jerusalem, and that's 2 Chronicles 36. This inclusion suggests that the book of Chronicles, or at least the largest portions of them, were compiled after the exile, when King Cyrus made his decree. So here's where the Hebraic understanding of God completely differentiates from that of other cultures in the Near East. Yahweh is never defeated in battle. If the kingdoms of Israel and Judah suffer, it's because God has ordained it to be so, because they abandoned him. So it was essential that after the captivity and the return of the true believers to Jerusalem, that explanations were made. And not only that, to ensure it would never happen again. So purity, ritual, staying within borders and marriage, staying away from people of other cultures, creating a Hebrew culture was essential. These are the true believers returning from Babylon. And this is when you start to see the changes to the older texts. This is when the sacrifice narrative may have been added to the story of Noah. This explains the changes in priestly duties in Leviticus, where you can go through and you can look at all the different changes. God did not change, but the people's understanding of God and his ways sure did change. So the past texts had changes, and it wasn't to intentionally deceive. There's no horrible intent. It's pretty standard stuff in Near Eastern cultures. Their idea of history was not the same as ours. We've got to get this. And I promise you, this all dovetails into what we're going to talk about tonight. But our concept of fact-based history comes from the Greek historian Herodotus, who lived around 450 BC. But ancient stories are truth-based stories, and there's a difference. Just look how the Bible works and how we have to date stories, because no story in the Bible says, in the year 41, their understanding of history and even time was different than ours. We look at time a Greek way, starts here, ends here, goes this way. A Hebrew understanding of time was cyclical, was seasonal. It was very different than the way that we understand. So when scribes began to dutifully record their histories, they were editing the text, putting in what they believed God truly wanted, because this is how they were then understanding God. It's not lies, it's truth. But who was there with Noah as he brought 7 pairs of animals onto a boat? Or was it 1 pair? Who was there with Abraham as he fell asleep and a smoking fire pot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces of animals slain so that covenant could be made? I am not saying these things didn't happen. I am saying that what is relayed to us is an ancient understanding of how things came to be. And when you begin to understand the history of this book, all of a sudden things start to make sense. When you read the text, you can begin to see these lines, these changes, this interweaving of true divine inspiration. It doesn't mean our favorite people that we've been told through our lives didn't write the Bible or didn't write portions of the Bible. It's not what I'm saying, but it is clear from the data that if they were the original writers, they had a lot of help. Doesn't mean they weren't divinely inspired. If you're feeling that thing rise up in you, check it. Fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Okay. Like, just give it a check. All right. But it's, God didn't just influence the writers. He influenced the culture, the editors, the audiences, the events, back to the editors, the events again, modern readers. He's influencing us all. We sell it short when we just say, oh, he influenced the writers. No, man, God influenced this whole thing. He knew we would be alive in a time where we would begin to understand this about the Bible and how it makes it more beautiful. It's massive. So after the exile, we have this need to codify faith and worship. And last week we talked about Ezra comes along, great assembly. They undertake this Herculean effort to record their beliefs and histories for people rebuilding a culture. And 200 years later, as this religion begins to thrive, and once again, as this culture begins to grow, as Hebrews begin to spread out throughout the Mediterranean, Pharaoh Ptolemy, he wants the great, he wants a record of this religion in Greek. So he commissions the Septuagint, and which becomes the de facto standard to the Greek speaking world. And then the religion remains pure and unadulterated over the next 400 years. I'm kidding. That's not how it worked at all. That's not how it worked. History is not static. Events didn't stop happening. And before going further, I need to introduce you to a little known religion that was actually very popular during the intertestamental period, especially after the Hebrews returned from Babylon. And I'm going to talk about a little known religion called Zoroastrianism. Now, Zoroastrianism still exists in small form today. I actually knew a Zoroastrianist back in the day. But in ancient times, in the time of Persia, it was very powerful. And when the Jews were captive in Babylon and then released under Cyrus the Great, upon returning to Jerusalem, like I said before, they were now a province of Persia up until about 336 BC. Now, Zoroastrianists, they were extremely unique in the ancient world because you did have monotheistic styled religions, but most religions were polytheistic, meaning multiple gods. The Zoroastrianists were a little bit different. And Zoroastrianists, during the intertestamental period, they had a great effect on the Jews who were involved with the diaspora. So we don't know a whole lot about it. Like the ancient form, the modern form is a little bit different. But the ancient form, it was what's called a dualistic religion. There was a universal struggle between good and evil. And they had good and evil entities that were roughly equal in power, and that they were constantly battling. It was like everything was like a game of chess. And there was going to be at the end a final cosmic battle. And they had an elaborate belief system in angels and demons. They had a powerful interest in the afterlife. They believed in the resurrection of the dead at the end of the world. And they believed in final judgment. And there were a lot of similarities between Zoroastrians and Jews. And this is one reason they were so tolerant of each other. That's why Persia was extremely tolerant of Judaism. Both religions drilled on a mountaintop. They had purification laws. They roughly believed the same thing about creation, not exactly the same, but generally the same. There was a lot of similarities that people could, you know, kind of jive with in a sense. Now, don't hear what I'm not saying. Okay. I am not saying Christianity is rooted from Zoroastrianists. I'm not saying that. So do not take that away from what I just said. Okay. But what I am saying is that the Zoroastrian understanding of the spiritual world, particularly in regards to angels, demons, good versus evil, it does begin to influence the beliefs of the Jewish world. And it opens up a different way of kind of understanding how the spirit world works. And a lot of times in our own faith walk, I mean, I want you to think about this, right? You can read this and have great faith in the Lord, but then you can meet somebody who has kind of a different take You know, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, wait, wow, something new has just been unlocked for me. Something new has been opened up for me. I didn't know. Like, I've seen people from, I've seen Protestants become Catholics. And they're just like, I never knew that this ritual, this could have this spiritual effect on me. I have known like Catholics who've become, you know, speaking in tongues, you know, charismatic Christians, and they're like completely, you know, rocked, are people that have become mystic Christians, the same thing. It's just like all of a sudden, like somebody says, and it unlocks, like the Lord unlocks something for you. It's like, oh my gosh, there's so much more going on than I knew before. And Zoroastrianists actually had this effect in a lot of ways, like, because, like I said, when you look at the Old Testament and you look at the New Testament, wow, they're really different, like how they regard spiritual things. So here is where we are going in our last hour tonight. We're going down a massive rabbit hole of savory goodness, because we're going to see there's a dramatic shift during this intertestamental period after the Jews have left Babylon, after they have been in contact with all of these other cultures like Zoroastrianists and also of different faith traditions. There is a dramatic shift during this period that's going to precede Jesus by 400 to 300 years that is going to massively affect the world that Jesus steps into. And it affects the early church, and it's going to affect the history of this final works construction. And we have to cover this subject, especially in regard to the books that were popular during Jesus's day. Because during this intertestamental time period, other books began to be written and other books began to be circulated describing the horrors of the occupation of Rome. The Maccabean revolt, the rebellion. Other books began to circulate, calling back to a time pre-flood when giants walked the land, talking about angels and demons in new and different ways than there had been in the Bible. And some of these books will also attempt to reframe Jewish understanding of why good and evil exist the way that they do. And this includes how mankind begins to look at a figure that the Protestant world is very, very familiar with, and that is the figure we call the devil. Now, whether you believe in a devil or not, Hasatan, Diabolos, whatever, is secondary. You know, as a faith-filled believer, I don't even like to give the guy time of day. All right. I'm not here to argue whether he exists or not and which form he exists or anything like that. Truth is, I could do a 3 to 4 week class just on Satan and his role and how it changes through the Bible. And that would be an amazing class. I might do that one day. But know this, at the time of Jesus, there was a firm belief in Satan as a personified person amongst many Jews. He didn't have a red tail and horns with a pitchfork, but there was a firm belief in Jewish sects of a Satan type figure. Not all Jews. The Sadducees weren't known to really believe in a devil or anything else really supernatural like that. They didn't even believe in resurrection. But amongst the public, amongst the commoner, it was very common. And when we go back into the furthest reaches of the Old Testament, Satan is not necessarily evil, as in Job. And remember, physically, it's believed that the book of Job predates almost every other book in the Bible. And in Job, Satan's quite different than, say, Revelation, right? Or even Matthew. In some ways, in the book of Job, it's like he's even on God's team. He's a natural role as a tester. And because if we're to be overcomers, we have to have something to overcome. We need to overcome things. And the Hasatan, Satan, he fulfills that role. But in Job, he's not pure, unadulterated, 200 proof evil or against God. It's actually presented as Satan being a part of a heavenly court system. He's seen as the adversary, the prosecutor, an agent of God, very much part of a divine council. Very important, the divine council. And he searches out an individual's wrongdoings to appear as their accuser. And we all know this, right? And this is Bible 101. In Hebrew, the name Satan simply means opponent, adversary. But Jews, they basically also used him to represent sinful impulses, the Yetzirah, or more generally, the forces that prevent human beings from submitting to divine will. But between Job and the time of Christ, the figure of Satan, the understanding of Satan, it really evolves, and it really speeds up during the intertestamental period. How do we know? Because he's completely different in the Old Testament than he is in the New Testament. And in the Old Testament, there's no hierarchy of demons under his command, but the New Testament is full of this imagery. Demons are personified. Legion, right? Satan is personified right off the bat, meaning Jesus in the wilderness. I mean, you could say that mankind's progressive understanding of God, there was a progressive understanding of Satan that went along with it. And maybe dualistic type beliefs begin to influence Jews who came back from Babylon and help them understand the way things worked. But it's quite obvious the character of Satan takes on deeper meaning as we get closer to Jesus's day. And it's like, when you think about that, it's like, wow, Old Testament, not a big deal, Satan. New Testament, he's all over the place, right? You got Paul saying, I commit this guy to Satan. You got Jesus calling Peter Satan. You got like Satan, Satan, Satan. There's like Satan all over the place. So is there a devil? According to the Gospels, Jesus believes so. So I got to go with that, right? But even then, we have to ask exactly what that means, because even Jesus accuses Peter of being Satan at one point, or having that impulse, that sinful impulse of moving from the divine will of God, or the force that submits, or that the force that prevents people from submitting to divine will of God, right? But what about demons? So as we've discussed, the Bible is multivocal, written by many different people over a long period of time. And just as the Bible in many different places has a different idea about God, it also has a different idea about the role of demons and evil. So before going into that, because this is all a fascinating thing that's happening during this intertestamental period, and there are two books that are responsible for a lot of it. But they're not part of our canons, but they were extremely common to the Jews. I want to take a quick 3-minute break. And when we come back, I'm going to talk about demons in the Old Testament, in the books of the Old Testament. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about how they came to change and how that actually affects the New Testament canon. It's really fascinating stuff. So we're going to take a real quick break before we go. Just want everybody to take a deep breath. Just and let out. Talking about fun stuff tonight. Talking about controversial stuff tonight. This is fun. This is a fun rabbit hole for me. To really bring some stuff out into the light. Why we look at Satan the way that we do. You might not believe in a Satan. I do personally. I do. But we do have to pay attention to how he changes. So I want everybody to just take a, if you want, go take a potty break, grab something to drink. We're going to take a quick three minute break, and I'll be right back. We're back. And yes, I did say potty break. Remember, I have 4 children, 8, 5, 4, and 3. All right. So hopefully you guys are back. I'm going to get this show on the road. I got a lot of ground to cover in a very short period of time. But this is the fun stuff. So let's talk about demons. So in the Old Testament, there are demons, right? But there are actually 3 classifications of demons. So when you look back, and I'll just pop up a few pictures of few demons here. Why not? We're talking about demons. So demons, they don't look human. Now, demons could be a couple of different things. The most common, and it's not even mentioned that often, in the Old Testament, is the Ruach Ra. Basically, that means evil spirit. Now, these evil spirits, they're not necessarily evil, but they're looked at as evil because what they do causes harm. So there's not a moral factor at play here. Okay. They're not morally evil beings. Okay. Like we tend to think of demons. There are spirits that are sent by God. Like in Judges 9, where God sends an evil spirit to stir the spot between Shechem's elders and Abimelech, are the times that God sends a spirit upon Saul, right, to torment him. So it's God who's sending these spirits to stir dissent and cause trouble. They're like agents of chaos, so to speak, designed to further God's purposes. And then you have what's called the Siddim. And the Siddim, the term appears in the Old Testament twice, in Deuteronomy 32, in Psalm 106, and the New Testament once, in 1 Corinthians 10. And this word is translated as demons or devils. And actually, it's an old Akkadian word. And it's a reference to gods of other nations. Now, this is important. Okay. So the passages that they're in doesn't give us a lot of detail about what Siddim are, what they're doing, what they look like, who they work for. But we do know that Israel is not supposed to worship them. Israel is not supposed to honor them. Remember what I said earlier, that in the Near East, this was common, that cultures, like in different territories, they had their own independent gods. So when a culture defeated another culture, it was actually their god toppled this god, right? That's what Siddim are. They are basically the gods of other cultures. There's a gods of other nations. Israel has been covenanted to God. So Israel is off limits. And if Israel falls, it's because God lets them fall, not because God is defeated. Now, a lot of these spirits are not personified evil. Let's look at the Egyptian gods. Exodus 12:12. God says that the whole reason for the plagues in Exodus 12:12 is they are the judgments of God against the gods of Egypt. Because basically the Hebraic people, as they are being captive in Israel, their God is with them. And that was a big deal in the ancient Near East, because a God was only supposed to have sway over the territory that he had covenanted himself to, or a God had covenanted themselves to. And so that was a really strong show of power on God's part, a big power play, because the people were in a land that were not their own, and God judged the other gods of another land. So it didn't mean that necessarily these gods were evil. It just means that God is a jealous God, and he's jealously in love with his chosen nation of Israel. Now, some of those demons are evil. Like this is a depiction of Moloch. There's Chemosh, Baal. Sometimes they call it Baal something. And according to the Old Testament, other nations are under thrall of other gods, AKA demons. So this is one of those pesky things a lot of Christians don't like to talk about when looking back at the Old Testament, because, we need to to look at it, because it helps us see this progressive understanding of who God is. If you only take the Bible at a flat reading, it confuses the heck out of you about God. What do you mean God sends evil spirits? What you mean God sends demons? They're not evil spirits. They're spirits sent to torment. Still, it sounds like it kind of sucks. It doesn't sound like something a God of love would do. I mean, who are we to know the mind of God? But it makes the conversation difficult for us a lot of time when we don't understand this progressive understanding of God. If you take the Bible at a flat reading, it confuses the heck out of you about God's nature. When you understand the Bible's multivocality, everything starts to make sense. Like, oh my gosh, this is how people understand things. And then there's the third classification. And this is important because this is where we're going, getting ready to go. The third classification that demons had in the Old Testament is the sons of God. And this is in Genesis chapter 6, which they are the ones that come down and take human women to be their wives. And even within the Bible, their offspring, they're called the heroes of old. These were the beings that were believed to have been wiped out by the flood with almost all the rest of creation. And if you come from an evangelical background, these types of demons, they don't really jive with what you've been taught about demons, right? Only the demons that reigned as gods of other nations really fall under the classification of what we think of as demons traditionally in our faith culture. And even then, all of them weren't considered evil, like I said. And the Ruach Ra, they were in the employ of God, but everything changes in the intertestamental period. And it is from two books that are not in your Bible, Enoch and Jubilees. And to understand the books that were chosen for inclusion into what would become the New Testament canon, we have to understand the influences upon what becomes the early church, because it's obviously different how Satan is treated in the New Testament compared to the Old Testament. It's obviously different how demons are treated in the New Testament than they are the Old. And there's a big reason that's not included in your Bible. In the third century, a book began circulating that was exceedingly popular among the people, and that is the Book of Enoch. Now, the Book of Enoch was a Jewish book, and if you've ever read the Book of Enoch, it's pretty wild. It's pretty wild. It's similar on scale to the book of Revelation, I think in many ways more so, with its heavenly images, its warfare. It's what's termed as an apocalyptic literature styled work. Now, apocalyptic literature, it's a specific genre of prophetical, some would say intentionally fantastical writing. It developed after the Babylonian exile among Jews, and it became really, really popular with early Christians and later Christians as well, particularly over the last 200 years, Jesus help us. Now, we usually think of apocalypse in an extremely negative term, right? We're apocalypse now. Oh, apocalypse is the end, right? But what that word actually means in Greek really means is revelation. So it's, you could think of it as an unveiling or an unfolding of things not previously known, that could not be known unless it came from the unveiling, right? Like if you're reading Revelation and like you're seeing, like you see world events, you're like, if you're an end times person, you read Revelation, you're like, oh, I know exactly what's going on in the world right now, right? Like it's a revealing of information that you normally wouldn't ever not have. As a genre, apocalyptic literature details the author's vision of the end times or the end of the age. Two very different things. Christians often get confused. We're going to talk about that in the next 2 weeks. There's a huge difference between the end of the age and the end times. They are very, cannot be more different. But usually apocalyptic works are revealed by an angel, right? Or another heavenly messenger. And they usually come and get really popular during times of crisis. So when the Jews are coming back from exile, or when your entire culture is under the boot of the greatest military the world had ever seen at that time, the boot of Rome, apocalyptic literature becomes really big. So here's this book in high circulation, the Book of Enoch. Now, before going further, and I need to state this because people love to take what you say and hear what they want to hear and go their own way, I want you to know that I do not consider Enoch to be canonical, okay? But it is undeniable the effect it had on the early church. And for that, it is worthy for study. You will not burn in flames if you go read this book. It will not trash your faith. It will help you fill in a lot of blanks between Judaism and Christianity, even though most modern church leaders will tell you to be wary because that's what they've been told. And there is some heavy, heavy stuff in Enoch. Okay. So is it something that you should set your faith upon? Me personally, no. but it is heavily influential. Is it true? Is it divinely inspired? Some say yes, some say no, but it had an effect. And some scholars estimate that there are over 100 allusions to things that are going on in the books of Enoch throughout the New Testament. So what is this book? The book of Enoch is attributed to Enoch, the one who walked with God way before the biblical flood that struck the earth. So did Enoch write it? Probably not. Not at all. Enoch didn't write it. All right. He didn't. Okay. Unless there was some crazy cache of clay writings that survived the flood, I highly doubt that he wrote it. Okay. Didn't happen. Some people say that he spoke and could have inspired it, and that's fine. But all of that is secondary. Did he not write it? Most likely not. We know that it came from the 3rd century BC. And basically the gist of Enoch is the author of Enoch, he has a heavenly guide. He tours through heavens, through all these various spiritual locations, dimensions, sometimes through a golden triangle called the triangle of the name, in the book. And the first part of the book of Enoch is called the Book of Watchers because it chronicles history through the perspective of angels or the watchers. Now, what the Book of Watchers does, it takes the three traditions relating to demons in the Old Testament, which were distinct and separate traditions, and it actually combines them together. So some of the questions that the Book of the Watchers is trying to answer are some of the questions that still bother us today. Why is there suffering? Why is there evil? Why is there sin? And the Book of Enoch's answer is basically demons. The story basically goes that there's these sons of God, which are angelic creatures that basically see these women and they're like, they're attractive. So they marry them and have children. And that becomes the Nephilim. Now, I promised we would touch on Enoch on the first day because the book of Enoch has a lot to do with how the first century comes to look at spiritual warfare. And will influence scripture and which books eventually make it into the Bible. A book that doesn't make it into the Bible actually has a tremendous effect. So way back in Genesis 6, the Bible talks about the Nephilim, but what we don't find in Genesis 6 and do find in the book of Enoch is that according to Enoch, God's really ticked off about this Nephilim situation. And the book of Enoch refers to it as defilement, like it's defiling God's creation. And so that's wrong. So God sends a troop of angels to go and punish these other angels and their children. And basically these angels who married human women and their children become demons and their whole existence is to inflict types of bodily harm onto humanity, which accounts for why they're suffering in the world. There's a writer named Ryan Stokes. He's a scholar and he's written a great deal about Enoch, right? Some fantastic stuff. And he really pinpoints down that this works to use the traditions to account for the worship of false gods. First Enoch 19:1 credits evil spirits explicitly, just straight out with leading humans into sin. So this is really the first time you see, like, you know, there's the story of Cain and Abel, be careful, Cain, sin is crouching at your door. But this is the first time really in Enoch that it is demons that are leading humans into a sinful lifestyle, seducing unsuspecting humans so that they worship demons as though these lesser beings are actually God. So these demons are really the imprisoned angels who sinned prior to the flood. And according to the book of Enoch, this is why sin exists in the world and in the way that it does. And it's these evil spirits. So this book of Enoch represents a pretty significant departure from how demons are portrayed in the Old Testament. But if you're thinking about the New Testament, that sounds really similar. You're like, oh, wait, okay, no, I get that. Like, I understand those demons. Those are the demons I'm familiar with. Right. So now you're seeing where this comes in. So the question of sin and evil is becoming a big question to the Jewish people, because in their culture, in Jewish culture, they don't believe in original sin, obviously. Right. They don't. And original sin wasn't even really believed in until about the fourth century. That's a whole different discussion. But, you know, the whole idea of original sin, like Jews don't believe in that. It was about choice. Okay. So. This question of sin and evil, however, is beginning to become a bigger thing after the exile, after being around these other cultures. And remember, the Jews they've been told by God that they are God's chosen people. Yet terrible things keep happening to them, and terrible things keep happening in the world. And we have to understand that in the Old Testament, suffering is often seen as a punishment from God, which represents some theological problems as they begin to understand that God isn't necessarily this angry, wrathful, retributive, did I say that right? I don't even know if I said that right. Creation, right? They're beginning to go, okay, wait a second. Like who is God? What is God? Is God kind? Is he merciful? Is he just? Or is he angry at me? And is he sending dark spirits? So the book of Enoch really seeks to solve these theological problems by blaming demons and not God. And also in the Old Testament, God is very often credited with making humans do harsh things like hardening Pharaoh's heart, right? To bring further suffering upon the Egyptian people, right? So these types of questions that the book of Enoch seek to solve by saying, that's not God's fault, demon's fault. So how did demons go from being functionaries of God, working for him, with him being on his team, so to speak, that the Ruach Ra that he sent out, to being on team evil, you know? Well, the book of Enoch is where that blame begins to shift. So the older sections of Enoch that have been attributed back to 300 BC, those are estimated to be around 300 BC, right? So that's the first part, 300 BC. And the last part, or the latest part, was about 100 BC. So this was all before Jesus. Various Aramaic fragments have been found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, Greek and Latin fragments. It was widely known by Jews and early Christians. And the book was also quoted by some first and second century authors of other books like the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs. And it's obvious that authors of the New Testament were intimately familiar. I'm not talking about they didn't just scan it. They were intimately familiar with the book of Enoch. So nowadays, the book was everywhere. It was everywhere. Short section of Enoch 1 Enoch is in the Epistle of Jude. You have Enoch, the seventh, basically seventh from Adam, alluding to Deuteronomy, and lots of the Book of Watchers, like the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's all over the Dead Sea Scrolls. The book was everywhere. And nowadays, it's not part of the biblical canon used by Jews. So it's not part of the Hebrew Bible, apart from Ethiopian Jews. Christians do not regard it as canonical. Well, that's not true. Some Christian sects, like Eritrean Christians, do. But most accept it as having like a lot of theological historical interest. So with the first book of Enoch describes the fall of the Watchers, and they're the angels who fathered the angel-human hybrids. And the remainder of the book is about Enoch's revelations and his visits to heaven in the form of travel visions and dreams. And there's five distinct sections. You have the Book of Watchers, the Parables of Enoch, the astronomical book, or also called the Heavenly Luminaries, the Book of Dream Visions, and the Epistle of Enoch. And most historians believe that these were actually five separate books that were combined over time. But even though it was widely known during the development of the Hebrew biblical canon, Enoch was totally excluded from the formal canon of the Tanakh and the Septuagint and also the Deuterocanonical books. And there's two reasons for this. Number one, a lot of the early sections of Enoch are callbacks to the Torah. So there's a lot of rabbis are like, well, we already have a lot of this stuff in the Tanakh, and it's just basically a more fanciful version of what's in there. But another huge reason is the detailed descriptions of fallen angels, which would be the reason for rejection from the Hebrew canon from that period, from mainstream, so to speak. Evidence from this is there's a guy named Trypho the Jew, and you can actually buy books of this conversation. I've read them online, of his debates with Justin Martyr, who, if you don't, you're going to come familiar with him like in the next 2 weeks. Justin Martyr is one of the early church fathers. I guess with a name like Justin Martyr, you know how it's going to end for him. sorry, that's a terrible joke. But this is what Trypho the Jew, they were actually debating on the validity of Enoch. And Trypho the Jew just was having none of it. And this is what he wrote. He said, "The utterances of God are holy, but your expositions are mere contrivances, as is plain from what has been explained by you, nay, even blasphemies. For you assert that angels sinned and revolted from God." Now that was a second century AD. So this is one of the main arguments that Orthodox Judaism has against Christianity, is that angels can fall, because that would mean that angels would have some kind of free will, that everything is not under the control and sovereignty of God. So to a mainstream Jewish rabbi in the second century and today, the thought of an empowered angel who could revolt from God implies that God is not sovereign, that something can exist independent of him or is out of his control. So really the only Jews that accept Enoch as canon, like I said before, Ethiopian Jews, is a very rich part of their tradition. And they actually have the oldest existent language form of Enoch in their language called Ge'ez. And it's still a very central piece of their canon. And Jewish mystics, notice I said mainstream or Orthodox Judaism, like, completely rejects the book. Jewish mystics, often called Kabbalists, they don't reject Enoch either. They lean very heavily into it. But again, that is kind of on the razor's edge, so to speak, of Judaism. But it's obvious that much of the Jewish population, around the time of Christ, they were firm readers of Enoch. So what happened? Like, what happened there? Stick a pin in that, because we're going to come back to that next week. How basically that, and we're just going to spend like 5 minutes on it next week, kind of like, because it's going to flip into kind of the collection of the first works of what would be considered canon in the New Testament. But I have about 20 minutes left. So I want to talk about the role of Satan, because this is important too. So obviously Satan is referenced in the Old Testament, right? but nowhere near on the level that he is in the New Testament. So enter the Book of Jubilees. And now you can get the Book of Jubilees in this book right here. This actually has Enoch in it as well. This book is made by, it's actually pretty awesome. It's made by, the Christian, Covenant Christian Coalition. And they're real mainstream, Christian group. And they basically put the funding for this together, but this is like an Amazon bestseller. I mean, you can get it on same day delivery in some cases. It is a fantastic work. If you just want to see like all these other books and you just read through and just like, oh my gosh, wow, this is why Christians believe this, or this is, you know. But the Book of Jubilees has a tremendous impact in the way that Christian literature begins to look at the character of Satan, or who Satan is. So Book of Jubilees is often called Lesser Genesis. It's an ancient Jewish religious work. It's about 50 chapters. Again, it's canon to Ethiopian Christians and the Ethiopian Orthodox Church and Jewish Church. It is a pseudepigraphical work. That's what Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodox, and Protestant churches consider it. It's outside of, you know, so it's not a canonical work, obviously, but it has a huge influence. And it was well known, almost up there. I would say just as much up there as with the Book of Enoch. And early church fathers loved the Book of Jubilees. Some of the ones that have quoted it, let me see, I have a little list here. Epiphanius, Justin Martyr, Origen, Diodorus of Tarsus, Isidore of Alexandria, Isidore of Seville, Tychicus of Alexandria, John Malalas, John Snellius, I can't even pronounce that name, George Cadranos. And once again, it was found all over the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are no complete Latin or Greek versions. So the version that has survived is the Ethiopian version. And that has shown, however, when matched up with the scroll, Dead Sea Scroll versions, that is extremely accurate translation. So what makes the Book of Jubilees extremely special? It claims to present the history of the division of the days of law, of the events of the years, the year weeks, the jubilees of the world. We know what jubilee is, right? Every 7 years, there's a reset, right? So jubilees were supposed to be revealed to Moses by angels when he was on Mount Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights. And basically the chronology in jubilees all rotates around the number seven. So the jubilees are a period of 49 years, 7 year weeks into which all time has been divided. So it's a fascinating work, and it goes through and begins to list out things, but it's in jubilees that we first start to see how the devil becomes the king of evil and the prince of the power of the air. Right? Like he has that title in the New Testament. What is like when in Ephesians, right? When Paul, or the writer of Ephesians, his disciple, whatever you want to say, like princes of the power of the air. Like we read that, we're like, oh, okay, that's something bad, right? We don't know why. Jubilees. That's why. So if you like Revelation, if you like Enoch, you will love Jubilees. It doesn't get the same press as Enoch does. But basically, the Book of Jubilees is a retelling of all of these stories in the Tanakh, right? The Hebrew Bible. But it expounds on these stories a lot to include Satan and his hierarchy of demons. An example, let me just give you an example. You know, the story of Abraham and Isaac, right? Where God, tells Abraham as a test of faith to go sacrifice his son, the son that he promised, right? That he promised Abraham. But in Jubilees, it retells that story, but this time it reveals that you have Satan going to God in kind of like a Job situation, right? Saying, hey, God, you should really test Abraham by telling him to sacrifice his only son. So it actually shifts the onus of the story, the bad part, the horrible idea aspect of it onto Satan. So God doesn't look so bad by trying to test Abraham's faith by almost murdering his promised child. So what you're seeing in Jubilees is an attempt to go back and look at these books of the Old Testament where God necessarily, you're looking at man like, God, how could a good God do something like that? And it attempts to retell these stories in light of kind of a darker influence, so to speak, taking the responsibility for kind of a deed we could look at as kind of like, ooh, and putting that onto the devil. Now, in the book of Jubilee, the character of Satan is called the Prince of Mastema. And Mastema means hatred, hostility, enmity, and persecution. So now here comes the prince part, right? The Prince of Darkness. All right. That is Prince of Mastema, hostility. And in Jubilees 10:11, it directly links the name Mastema to the title of Satan, or the Satan. So the Book of Jubilees is it literally is the first time you see the name Satan linked to the Prince of Darkness. And as a collection of stories, it's a collection of stories from different time periods, right? That's the way it's presented. So you have these 49 year periods, and that's where these stories come through. And so in Jubilees, Satan is, some of the stories don't necessarily match up with each other very well because they're supposed to occur over during different time periods. But it's kind of like, okay, so it's kind of like if we go back and look at Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, those creation stories don't necessarily match up. And the same thing, like the story of Noah, did he sacrifice the animal? Did he have 7 pair of animals? Did he only have 1 pair of animals? You know, that sort of thing. It's kind of like that. So you have some stories that kind of juxtapose each other because they have different writers at different times. But in all of them, Satan is kind of presented in 2 different ways. So some passages, he's divinely appointed chief of evil spirits. He's like the grand poobah of evil, right? And but even when he's the grand poobah of evil, he's still working for God. Like there's a story after the flood. All these demons are tempting Noah's children to do evil things. So Noah goes to God and he's like, hey, God, like, all right, so these demons are tempting my kids to do horrible things. And so God says, okay, that's cool, man. I'm going to go and imprison the demons in the prince Mathsema. So he goes, Mathsema. And so he goes to Satan and they get in an argument. And Satan goes, God, you can't imprison me because you can't do that because it's my job. You created me to tempt humans to do sinful things. And so God says, okay, all right. Yeah. You know what? You're right. I'll let you keep 10%. So I'm not going to imprison all of you. I'm just going to imprison these for this period of time. But in other instances in Jubilees, Satan works opposite God and directly opposes the Israelites. So the whole point of Jubilees is to show that God has chosen the people of Israel to be his. So the proper thing to do is to worship Yahweh. Okay. And if other nations aren't worshiping Yahweh, why is it that they aren't, or why they cannot do that? Well, Jubilees 15:31 says that God made spirits rule over all in order to lead them astray from following him in order to demonstrate his glory. And so as God is sovereign, God has given other nations to other spirits for the explicit purpose of leading them astray. So it's really trying, Jubilees is an attempt, it's fascinating, it's an attempt to try to explain God's heart for his people against that of the world. It is a very, pro-Israel book as far as that is concerned. But it reveals the function of Satan. That's what he does. He is set up to be the opposite of God, to tempt God's chosen people. God is working for God to punish the wicked in the book of Jubilee. Basically, he makes the wicked to be more wicked. So we have this evolving view of who Satan is during this period, and as well as who God is, trying to explain these two books, Enoch and Jubilees, are trying to explain these differences of why. Why is there good and evil? How can God be good and allow these terrible things to happen? And it attempts to really, really answer these difficult questions, questions that we still ask today. Like I said, Jubilees is a very pro-Israel book. Book of Jubilees straight out states that Hebrew was the original language of man and is the language spoken in heaven. Right. Which is funny because, like, we know that even ancient Hebrews didn't speak Hebrew, right? they spoke other languages. But it basically states that Hebrew is the language of heaven. And it also states of particular interest to Christians. So listen to me, dear Christian, Jubilees, contains a lot of references and allusions to the Messianic kingdom. Basically Jubilees states that the Messiah will come not from the tribe of Levi or from the Maccabean family, which is what everybody believed at the time during the Maccabean revolt, but from Judah. So basically, Jubilees goes back through history and says, the Messiah is coming from the tribe of Judah. Yeah, and that's where we get the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Hello, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus. So basically, Jubilees is saying when the Messianic kingdom comes, it would be gradually realized on earth. Okay, it wouldn't be like all of a sudden 1,000-year reign of Christ, but it would be gradually realized on earth. And for the mystics that are in this group, this is a big one. Okay, that the kingdom would be gradually realized on earth. The transformation of physical nature would go hand in hand with the transformation of man until there was a new heaven and a new earth. And then finally, all sin and pain would disappear, and men and women would live to the age of 1,000 years in happiness and peace. And after death, enjoy blessed immortality in the spirit world. This was like when this, like, because in the Old Testament, it's quite different, right? Than what the things that begin to come about in the New Testament. And the Hasmonean Jews that were around at the time, and a sect of Judaism, they grabbed onto Jubilees, and it became the source for what's called the Aramaic Levi document. And Jubilees remained a point of reference in priestly circles, even though there was a lot of discussion on this. But the Temple Scroll, the Epistle of Enoch, they're all based on Jubilees. And it's the source for a lot of apocryphal books like the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs, things like that. There's no record of it among the Pharisees and the Sadducees. It was among several books the Sanhedrin left out when the Bible was canonized. But it was in high circulation among the general populace. And the early Christian writers held the Book of Jubilees in extremely high regard, just like they did Enoch. Many of them cited and alluded to Jubilees in their writing. In the New Testament, the Book of Jubilees contains one of the earliest references to the idea that God gave the law to Moses through an angelic mediator, and that's reflected in Galatians. So when Galatians references that, basically, like this, that Moses was given the law through an angelic mediator. That idea came from Jubilees. And it's also believed to have a huge effect or a huge impact on Islam down the road. But again, we're not getting into that because this is not that kind of class. So the question, and an honest question, is why are these books, they've had such a tremendous influence. And this is before the time of Christ. This is the intertestamental period right before Christ appears. And they were in huge, you know, they were all over the place. Why are these books not considered canon? That's an honest question. Because obviously as Christians, we can look at these books and like all of a sudden, like you guys are probably going, holy cow. Like now I understand. Like I completely understand now why, like, the New Testament, these books have these allusions to, like, you know, Legion, and, you know, there are exorcisms going on, and there are all these other types of things going on. And this stuff didn't happen in the Old Testament, but it's happening here. And all of these, like, divine heavenly encounters that, like, that, you know, Peter's having visions and things are dropping from the sky, and John's going up to heaven in the, you know, in Revelation, like all these things, like, which those writers considered was normal. Like, but you don't see in the Old Testament. It's like, now you're like, wow, holy cow, I'm seeing it now. So why are they not considered canon? Because amongst Jews, it's easy. Satan doesn't cause them to do anything. It's that simple. It's all about choice. And for them to elevate Satan to that level of being the opposite of God, is to elevate that being higher than they give him credit for in their faith traditions. They saw this as an obvious influence from other cultures. So it was completely rejected. Personally, I think my feeling is that I think there's a lot of credence to these books. I think that they should be read. I think every Christian that wants to really go deeper in their faith They should read these books. Should they take them as canon? No, no. My personal opinion is absolutely not, you know, but they should know, because you see, like, all of a sudden, the missing link, they are literally the missing link between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And that's why I wanted to go so deep on those books tonight, because I think you can see how much they influence the early Christian canon. I mean, you know, it's in the canon already, the Gospels, the letters, Revelation, but it's important to know the influence on these early books and the influence of these, of the Book of Enoch and of Jubilees is you cannot ignore it. Would I suggest reading them? Yes, absolutely. Go order them. Yes. Are they the gospel truth? Probably not. But Jesus did quote them. He did source his ideas, reflected them, his idea of the spiritual hierarchy. These books did reveal a reality that Jesus said was true. And so they became ideas of the early church. But later, these influences are going to make church fathers, not the early church fathers, but the mid church fathers, especially when the Bible begins to take the shape that it does today, and made them extremely uncomfortable, extremely uncomfortable. And when it comes to choosing what goes in and what goes out, the pseudepigraphical works, they and the apocryphal works, they have a serious part to play. And I brought up the fact, you know, last week that the first generation of Christians, they really did not have a consolidated set of books other than the Septuagint. And still most of them couldn't read, you know, but we take our literacy level, we take for granted. Like every, almost all of us can read. Back then, very few. So it's not like you had, you know, these books, you know, sitting in places where people can just go read it. They had to have things read to them. And they didn't have a consolidated set of books. And there were even debates then amongst the validity of books in the Old Testament. And, you know, some Jews, and remember the very first followers of Jesus, they were Jews, believed that if something was written in Greek, but was never written in Hebrew, that it shouldn't be included in the Bible. Okay, it should not be included in the Hebrew Bible. They're like, if it's not written in Hebrew, if it has a Greek influence and we can tell, we're not putting it in. We're not doing it. And that goes for Persian influence as well. And the Book of Enoch and the Book of Jubilees does have a Persian influence. It does. They do. They really do. They really do. When you go back and look at it historically, they really do. Does it make them less valid? I don't think that does, because we don't exist in vacuums. Religions do not exist in vacuums. Our understanding of God does not exist in vacuums. But books like Enoch and books like Jubilees, they were thorns in the side of Jews that were in power, especially the Sadducees, who regarded them as superstitious books, too fantastic for inclusion. I mean, like, honestly, I'm surprised Ezekiel made the cut, you know, because it's so far out there. And that idea of, is this too fantastic? Is this too fantastic? Is going to come into play. And we're going to start talking about that, especially when we get to Revelation. Because we take, you know, we take Revelation for granted, right? Most people don't like to read it because it's too freaky, you know, as it is, right? So Revelation almost did not make the cut when it was, we're going to talk about that at the end of next week. Revelation almost didn't make the cut. They were like, this is a little, they almost went with the apocalypse of Peter. They said Revelation was a little too fantastic, excuse me. But obviously it did make the cut because it deserved to be in there. Cause Revelation is a revelation of the love of Jesus Christ. It's not a revelation of the beast and all this other silly nonsense. Revelation is the revelation of Jesus Christ. I'm glad they kept it in, but there, that was a huge question. Is this book too fantastic? And that's one reason Enoch, and Jubilees eventually do not make the cut. Because it was like, wow, this is really fantastic. Like, ugh, like, do we, you know, how do we fit this in to the narrative? But like I said last week, The early days of Christian texts, they were not crystal clear. They were very, very muddy. And I don't think most of us understand enough about the intertestamental period. And if we did, all of a sudden, some of our beliefs would be drawn into the life. Like, why do we believe what we believe about the spirit world? Why do we believe what we believe about moving through the heavens? Why do we believe what we believe about angels and demons and all that sort of stuff? It's because of the books from the intertestamental period. So that was a lot of time on 400 years of stuff tonight. But I think it's a fascinating conversation. It's a fascinating subject to dive into. Next week, we're going to start talking about the early church fathers and why they began to put what they put into, or why did they choose the books, or why did they begin to choose the books that they chose, and some of the councils and et cetera, that that really looked into that, and how culture, because now we're not just talking about Hebraic culture anymore. When we start talking about the formation of the New Testament, we're bringing in cultures from all over Asia Minor. We're bringing in Greek culture. We're bringing in Roman culture. We're bringing in Jewish culture. We're bringing in all, and how all of these things begin to move, because it's going to start, you know, you're taking an Eastern religion, right? Which is Judaism. It's a Near Eastern religion, but it's going to start becoming a Greek religion, which is very different, very different, very different concepts, very different purposes, very different way of looking at things like time, right? Simple time, the way they believed in the recording of history. Like why certain things begin to look the way they do, whereas, you know, in Judaic culture, it didn't look that way. So we're wrapping up for tonight. Does anyone have any questions? All right. Well, as usual, if you have any questions, feel free to email me. Just want to lead us out in prayer and just say, Jesus, thank you. No, we love you. Thank you. Thank you for your word. Thank you for that we live in a time that we can see and understand how the Bible came to be, that you created us. You knew that we would live in a time where we could see the truth about the construction of your word, because this is your word. It is your truth. It is divinely inspired from cover to cover. Every single word has the touch of you. Every single word is holy ground, a place that we can come and meet you. So we just ask for your breath to continue to fill us, to fill these pages as we read them, as we take them in. So we begin to understand more and more and more and more about you. You should begin to fill us up. So we love you. I bless every single person watching this and every single person that takes this class in the past and in the future, that you just awaken that fire within them to consume your word and to realize it is holy and it is holy ground. No matter how it was made, no matter who wrote it, it is 100% divinely inspired. And it was created for us. So we love you, Lord. Amen. All right, guys. Whew. So next week, we're going to get to like I said, we're going to start diving into the early church fathers and mothers. The mothers always get left out. We're going to start talking about the first couple of canons, how the first guy that put together the first canon actually got in trouble for it. Crazy the story behind this, the story behind this thing, it is wilder and crazier than any conspiracy theory you will ever read. Those silly conspiracy theories, they cannot hold a candle to it. The construction of this book is just, it's amazing. God's amazing. You guys are amazing. So God bless. And I'll send out the link in the next day or two. And good night.